Welcome everybody, thanks for coming out, especially since it's on Thursday and we've sort of shifted it from our usual slot on a Tuesday. Hopefully people haven't got lost in seminar room D. If they are, they're probably listening to a chemistry demonstration or something instead. It's a real pleasure to have with us this evening Professor Stéphane Parmentier, who I know is very familiar to many of you, both in OTJR, but also in the Centre of Criminology, where Stéphane had a lot of involvement over many years. Stéphane is the head of the Department of Criminal Law and Criminology at the Catholic University at Leuven, where he was also formerly the director of the Law and Society Institute. Stéphane specialises in a kind of broad range of topics, which I couldn't really do justice to this evening, but they include the sociology of crime, law, human rights, and of course, transitional justice. Stéphane, I think it's fair to say, really is one of the leading scholars, particularly on the intersections between criminology and transitional justice. He's the co-editor of the Transitional Justice series at Intersentia Press, and his books include Crime and Human Rights in 2007, and Prosecutorial Policies in the International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia in 2009. It goes without saying that he's eminently qualified to speak to us this evening on this topic, which is reparation and reconciliation in post-conflict Bosnia and Serbia. What role for sociolegal studies? Stéphane, it's a real honour to have you here. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Phil, for this kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's a real pleasure to be with you today. And what a day it is, because if the information is confirmed, it is a special day, isn't it? Mr. Mladic is finally caught. He's finally found and caught. And, well, who knows what's going to happen now or what's going to happen next. This is an incredible coincidence, because, of course, we will deal with the Balkans and with Serbia and Bosnia today. And the coincidence even goes further, because last time when Mr. Karadzic was caught, I was also at a conference, the World Conference of Criminology, by the way. And so this was the Belgian national holiday, and I said, well, for all the Belgians in the room, I have some special news for you today. And so it seems that conferences can do some good in a certain sense in provoking people to leave their hiding place. Anyway. Thank you very much for the invitation, obviously. It's nice to be with you, and I'm sorry to say the reason for the other timing, if it were, because I couldn't be here on Tuesday, but I'm here today. In fact, my connections with the Center for Criminology go back a number of years, and when I was here in 2007 as part of my sabbatical year, there wasn't much talk about transitional justice, at least not in a formalized setting, in a formalized and institutional setting. And I talked to different people who now happen to be in the group, but there was no group at the time. Now, only a couple of months later, when I had left, the group was formed, and since then it has really been booming. And I think Phil and many others should be credited for that. So congratulations with the wonderful work you are doing. The conference of 2009 also put this group on the map, and I'm happy to report that the review process of the book is almost done, and from what I hear and what I read, it's going in the positive direction, but we'll let you know very soon. Good. There are a couple of things I would like to discuss with you today, obviously. My background is in law and sociology. And over the last couple of years, I have moved into criminology, in fact, the last 10 years, if you wish, but always from a sociological angle. So sociology of law, sociology of crime is really what I'm interested in. And I've tried to use and apply the frameworks of these two disciplines to the field of human rights and the field of international crimes. And so this is exactly the reason why we are doing research in these areas in various parts of the world, but trying to use a particular framework, a particular model, if you wish, and then try to elaborate on the model in empirical work. So what I would like to do with you today, is first a little bit of generalities, which of course we can go over very quickly, given the background of this, this group, but then present a little bit of the results of a survey which was done, a population-based survey, as we call it, a quantitative survey in Bosnia in 2006 and in Serbia in 2007. And particularly on issues of reparation and reconciliation. There's much more in the survey, but we will only focus on these things because we only have limited time. But the report which was circulated, indeed, I think it was, reports more extensively in these areas. And so you can find many more details in the report. And then what I would like to do is try to open up our framework from transitional justice in the narrow sense of the word, if I may call it like that, although it's already a very broad topic, to sociolegal studies. Because it's so strange in a certain way that sociolegal studies have been absent from this field, or fairly absent. And so what is in sociolegal studies that could help us understand better a number of issues that transitional justice is dealing with? This is basically the goal of the talk today. So I use the term changing lenses, which comes out of another famous criminology book. Howard Zier used it in the early 1990s when he talked about changing lenses from retributive justice to restorative justice. And that's also why I put it in brackets, not to plagiarize, of course. Okay, some general context. This is, in fact, redundant for all of you because you know better than anyone else that transitional justice has really boomed, not only as an institutional arrangement and in publications and documents and policy making, but actually as a concept, of course, as well. And there are two things which I would like to highlight still before moving on. That's one thing is the idea of political transitions has basically been given up, at least in policy documents. Now we're talking about large-scale human rights abuses in various parts of the world, and that explains why Canada and Australia and Colombia and other places can actually figure or can enter into the transitional justice field, despite the fact that the political transition is not really there. Or not so easily identified. And the second is the evolution, I would say, and the focus from human rights with state responsibility to crimes, in this case international crimes, with individual responsibility. Now this is very important because otherwise you could not explain the emergence, the relevance, the weight, and the impact of international criminal justice, and with it of a number of other institutions. So these are some general developments. However, I would like to suggest to you that there is still in transitional justice a dominant approach, an approach that focuses very heavily and very strongly on mechanisms established, institutions, procedures, whether they're judicial or non-judicial is, of course, not so important, but it's the institutional perspective, I would say. Furthermore, there is a heavy emphasis on retributive justice, if we can call it like that, and this, of course, is terminology that comes out of criminology. Retributive, in other words, to punish, prosecute and punish, with an idea, it's often said, to end impunity and even to install deterrence. And so all kinds of claims are being made, mostly by lawyers, about the functions and the effects of criminal justice. And this is something that at least I would like to question and have some interesting exchange about, hopefully. And then a final feature, not the final one, in the sense this is not an exhaustive list, of course, but there is a strong emphasis on top-down. And it has to do with this institutional approach. Top-down, international affairs, and then sometimes when it works, some complementarity at the national level. And that is also why, in terms of disciplinary backgrounds, most people so far who have been working in transitional justice are lawyers and political scientists, I would like to argue. The political scientists deal with the grand theories, let's say. How do societies move from one state to the other? And what kind of choices do they make and what kind of decision-making processes are behind them? And lawyers, of course, more on the details, on how to establish accountability, responsibility, liability, and what have you. Now, gradually, as we see it emerging, there are, as I call it here, the second phase of disciplines that have come in, or has come in, which is a number of social science disciplines. There is a growing emphasis on the psychological side, mostly for victims then. What does it mean for victims to be a victim of a gross violation of human rights or an international crime? Obviously, victimology plays an important role, but it's not the only discipline. Anthropology, and Phil, as an expert in Rwanda, knows what that means. It means that you're looking at local, at maybe traditional ways of conflict settlement, and how these are used or reactivated, reshaped sometimes into other forms of dealing with crimes. And even in geography, I read a very interesting piece a couple of months ago on the way in which that you can actually describe through all kinds of statistical data where and when certain violations of human rights took place. And you can actually set it out over a period of time. In Guatemala, that was the case. So there's, in geography, a very interesting mapping exercise to see how violations take place. What kind of features they may have, and in that sense, that's also a guiding principle for strategies of prosecution. Now, given the fact that there's a lot of emphasis on certain issues and far less on other issues, what we have tried to do in our work in Leuven and in other places is to, maybe this is far-fetched, but to call it an alternative approach, or at least towards something broader. And what is broader is that we're trying not to focus too heavily on institutions, but first of all to have a look at the issues that new societies, new elites, new governments have to deal with when they come out of a period of violent conflict, civil war, civil strife, or large violations of human rights in another sense. And we've tried to work with a model, which is a very simple one, actually. It's more a heuristic model than anything else, that, as you may have seen from the paper, that focuses on four main key issues. It is about truth and truth-seeking and truth-finding. It's about accountability for the crimes or the violations committed. It's about reparation for the harm done to victims. And it's about reconciliation. And this model is one that allows us to actually bring together many different issues and then to look in a more empirical sense on what is happening in different societies according to these different issues. In our work, we also try to focus more than on purely retributive justice, on restorative justice. What does it mean for a society to try to think about the applicability of principles of restorative justice, which in fact come from a very different reality, namely petty crimes sometimes committed by juveniles, and sitting together, victims and offenders, and partly sometimes with representatives of the community. What could that mean in the field of international crimes, where the massive scale of victimization is enormous, where heinous crimes have been committed, far more serious than the petty crimes sometimes that restorative justice practices are engaged in. And finally, to open up the field and to actually give a voice, not only to victims, but to everyone in a given society, we'd like to focus on bottom-up approaches. And bottom-up, in that sense, is almost inevitably also empirical, because it cannot remain a theoretical approach in that sense. So here, I think there is room for many new disciplines, and coincidence or not, but these are some of the disciplines that we are involved in, obviously criminology and social legal studies. And I will focus more on the latter today. So this is, in a nutshell, the simple model, the heuristic model. You could call it a checklist, actually. And those of you familiar with criminology will immediately see that this has its roots, its foundations in left realism of the 1990s, where in fact four other kinds of principles were advanced and also used in fact as a checklist to not to forget a number of issues when we talk about crime. In this case, it's not to forget a number of issues when we talk about transitional justice. Just to give you a brief sense, and without going into the details, we have done a number of researches at KU Leuven, empirical, all of them, in South Africa, in Bosnia-Serbia, which I will report on today, in Guatemala, in Colombia for the moment, ongoing research, and another ongoing research is Sierra Leone and Ghana, with different kinds of funding, but the efforts are there to establish a sort of a research tradition in that sense. All right. Now I'd like to focus a little bit on the population-based survey. And the aim, I already highlighted some of the aspects. The aim was basically to have a better understanding, to gain a better understanding of what people think. From the idea that basically all that has been done in ex-Yugoslavia is very much top-down. Of course, the most visible expression of that is the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for ex-Yugoslavia. But even in the, at a national level, there are a number of initiatives, not too many. Let's say the War Crimes Chamber in Bosnia is probably amongst the most relevant and salient ones. But apart from that, there is not so much. So it is top-down and yet also limited. So we wanted to understand what do people themselves in the region, in the countries concerned, think. So opinions and attitudes of the population about various issues. And in fact, we did ask questions about these four issues. And it's easy in that sense to use empirical work because you can use each of the headings basically to formulate questions. So we developed a questionnaire of about 35 questions. And because of our interest and focus on restorative justice, we also wanted to know what people would think about that, despite the fact that it's rarely discussed, it's not really an issue at stake, it seems, for the moment. But we wanted to test the waters and to see, is there any interest, is there any knowledge, is there any inclination to try to explore, let's put it in very prudent terms, to try to explore the restorative approach or not. So this is this will come out a little bit from the data. This of course is not a one-person job. We had a research team, small research team, with my colleague Elmar Weidekamp from the University of Tübingen, an expert in restorative justice, and the researcher herself, Marta Valinius. I think I may pass on the methodology, knowing that it's important that you have some idea of how it was conducted, because in fact the collection of data determines the quality of the results. But given the fact that the report was circulated, I think maybe we can go somewhat quicker here. Let me just highlight two things. One is that it's not a random sample. In other words, if you want to go to a country like that, it's risky just to leave it to the coincidence who is actually able to respond, because that will color basically the, even contaminate the results. So it's a quartet sampling method. Basically, along the same lines in Bosnia and Serbia, obviously, in order to be able to compare some of the data, with one exception, that in Bosnia, as you will see, there is also a particular focus on religion. Given the fact that Bosnia is composed, was composed, and still is, I suppose, in a very different way than Serbia, with many more different, sometimes called ethnicities. I always have trouble with that particular concept, at least in the Balkan case, but definitely religions, while Serbia is more homogeneous. This is not to say that Serbia is only Orthodox, but the weights are different, the balance is different. So that's one thing. The second is that we really pondered a long time how to actually get that questionnaire out. How can you make sure that you actually reach the people that you want to reach? And the only possibility that we could finally come up with, and which I hope has worked quite well, is to engage other actors. In the Bosnian case, it was students from the University of Sarajevo, and in the Serbian case, it was NGOs dealing with victims and also with veterans, as they call it. And the idea has been all the time to ask these intermediaries, let's say, to distribute the questionnaires in their hometowns and across the countries in both cases, and then to collect the questionnaires. And that, of course, has, I think, been a good choice, because an ordinary postal survey or a telephone survey, imagine, or a web survey could not have worked in either case. So this was the only possibility, it seemed to us, to actually make sure that the response rate would be high enough. And here we have the percentages, and you've seen them in the report. In the first case of Serbia, 85%, and in the second case of Bosnia, 94%, which is extremely high in relation to normal response rates of around 40 or 45, maybe. Yeah, this is the map of Serbia, but something went wrong apparently in copying this map from another PowerPoint, because what you should see is in fact the dots to show you the distribution of the questionnaire throughout the country, the same as this one has worked, where you see that basically a fair distribution throughout the country has taken place. To avoid the perception maybe that you only focus on big cities and not on villages, and particularly in Bosnia it's important because some areas of course are Republika Srpska and have a stronger influence, a stronger presence of Serb population, while the others are more Bosniak or Muslim dominated. Now, just a couple of very basic issues. So here you see in the Serbian survey what the religious affiliation has been of the respondents, and of course the large percentage of Orthodox stands out of 72. Let's say that's almost like 3 out of 4 of the respondents have an Orthodox affiliation. There are some Muslims, obviously, 15%, but then all the others are fairly small. And this actually coincides very well, if you look at these percentages here, with Serb, 75, and Bosniak Muslim, 13. So these are basically each other's mirror figures. In the Bosnian survey, I just wanted to highlight this one. It was more difficult. In fact, this was the first survey done, because we realized if we would go only by the quota sampling without including religion, we might miss a lot of people and we might not be able to actually draw statistically relevant conclusions, because you want to make sure that you have enough respondents from a particular section. And given the root of the conflict being as much a religious as an ethnic and possibly socioeconomic conflict as well, that's another issue, we thought we need to have a fair representation of the three religions. So we actively sought and looked for people who were belonging to each of those three. And in fact, at the end of the day, we have like 900 respondents, more or less, with a fairly equal distribution. Okay, the questionnaire was composed of two aspects, let's say, two components. This is a bit small, I realize. So for the persons in the back of the room, this might be a bit difficult to read, but you have, of course, very diligently read through the paper before. The first part was on experiences of victimization. What have you experienced in terms of the period of the war, during the war, and the period after the war? The second part is on the post-conflict justice issues. Now, interesting, I think, in the Serbian survey is that we have been able to identify three main categories. Of course, this comes out of a more detailed questionnaire, obviously. I'm summarizing here. And the three categories are physical harm, material harm, and emotional harm. And if you look specifically here, those two, because that means a lot or very much. Yes?
Would it be okay if we dim the lights at the front to see the table from the back?
Yeah, I'm fine if that's easier for you to, yeah.
No, it's okay. They're not working. It's fine.
They're not working?
Yeah, if you hold it down.
Hold it.
Yeah.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much.
Sure. So have a look at these two columns here, because that is what people report as having affected them most. Physical harm, let's say, roughly equals 25%, material harm about 50%, and emotional harm about 72-73%. And this is, I think, a really interesting finding, first of all, because usually most of the surveys that we have seen and most of the researches that are being done are always about these two first categories: physical harm, physical integrity of a person, torture, disappearance, what have you, and material harm, being chased out of the house, displacement, material destruction, and so on and so forth. But almost no one asks about the emotional side. And I think it was a good idea to try to enter into that field, because in fact you see that here it's even the highest of all. But on the other hand, if you look at the responses given in both Serbian and Bosnian society, there is almost nothing. Which is like a real gap between, on the one hand, the needs, apparently. This is, of course, during the war. And the offer or the set of services provided. But even if you look after the war, then you see, of course, that the percentages are going down. They are lower in each category, both in the physical and in the material and in the emotional harm. But the hierarchy between the three types of harm is kept, is maintained. In other words, people highly report on having been affected even after the war about emotional issues. And the question, of course, the open question almost is, what is being done? Now, on the other hand, you also find people who say, I did not suffer at all. And in particular, in the physical category, that is quite high. Which should not really surprise us, because in Serbia, of course, the war was not fought on the territory of Serbia. There are only two exceptions, basically the bombing of NATO in 1999 and the Kosovo issue, which is a real particular, very, very special issue, but which did not really extend to the whole territory of Serbia. And that is different in Bosnia, where, of course, the war was fought. This also explains, I think, why few people actually answer, I don't know. They have a fairly good idea of what they want to respond to, and this category is larger in the Bosnian case. Let me not so much larger, but still. Now, if you compare this immediately with the Bosnian data, there you have during the war again the three categories: 37%, more or less. 74 material harm, which is really about displacement and destruction of property, and emotional. Okay, this is 85. That's even higher than in the Serbian case. And after the war, again, the same hierarchy is kept, but the figures are obviously somewhat lower. But still, emotional harm, again, is like 70%. So this really generated a lot of interest with us, more from a hypothetical point of view, or let's say to formulate a number of hypotheses, rather than have fixed conclusions, because it is not so easy to actually pinpoint and put your finger on actual services for the moment, but our impression is that very little is being done. And this also squares with another question which we won't discuss today but is in the report, where we ask people, where do you think that you want to talk about what happened during the war and after the war? And they said in overwhelming numbers to psychologists, which is really surprising because nobody had really looked at that very extensively. So we feel there is a whole reservoir, let's say, of issues not addressed. This will have to be taken up, not only by psychologists, but also by others who are knowledgeable about this field. Okay, then the second part of the questionnaire was about opinions. What do people really think about what should happen? So this is normative, but normative from their perspective. And I only focus here on reparation and reconciliation. But you see in the report, it's more extensive because we also ask questions about truth finding and about accountability. Now, my technical knowledge is really limited, and that's partly why we should have had graphs here to actually show you much better. Okay, this is higher than the other one. For the moment, we only have statistical dry data. But again, look mostly at these two categories, because here, in reply to statements about certain issues, people say it would make me feel better, or it would make me feel much better. So that's the, let's say, the affirmative side of what they think about certain issues. And we deliberately also did not want to use the term reparation. What kind of reparation would you think is suitable for you? Because reparation is a difficult concept. And there's so many things in that concept, so we ask questions in an indirect way here. What sticks out? I think a number of things. First of all, the fairly high percentage of people saying, I would like to know the reasons why this happened
to me and why people make me suffer. So it's about information. It's about necessity to know. In fact, you could say, well, that's truth-finding. Yeah, but it's part sometimes also of reparation in symbolic ways to know about what happened. The same with what happened to my relatives is a bit, well, almost along the same lines. In other words, it's the desire, it's the need to know what happened. Memorial building. Memorial will be built in honor of those who suffered the violence. Is also fairly high, at least higher than always than the other category. And here again, the truth about all the facts and the events of the war. Look at this. This is 75%, which is even going much beyond the individual case. It's about the general pattern of human rights violations of international crimes. People want to know the big picture. Let's say at least this comes out very clearly. From this. And then if my suffering would be acknowledged, that is also fairly high. It's about half of all the respondents who say that in fact they would need some kind of suffering. When we were presenting these data in Belgrade, as much as we have presented the Bosnian data in Sarajevo, that's usually what came back, the acknowledgement. We are victims, we've suffered for a long time, very heinous crimes, and nobody actually said that we were victims. And so that that absence of acknowledgement is really problematic, because it actually continues the idea of victimhood. 15 years after the war came to an end. I think that here again is a reservoir for potential conflict in the future. In fact, in the Bosnian case, it doesn't go so well in Bosnia for the moment. You know, there's a lot of political tension, a lot of stalemate even, a lot of difficult situations. In fact, let me refer to this article. On the way here yesterday from Brussels, I saw a gentleman next to me reading an article, which is an interview with Don Horowitz, who is a specialist in ethnic conflicts at Duke University. And he said, well, Bosnia is the number one country that is fit very loosely together. In fact, there is no other country in the world that is so loosely connected. The second is Iraq. And guess which the third one is? Iris knows. Yes. In Dutch, for those who read it. Anyway, but the main difference, he argued, and he also acknowledged, at least there is no violent conflict yet in Belgium. There is in Bosnia a little bit. There's a lot of it in Iraq, of course. Yeah. So also interesting, I think, is to look at the don't know or no answer category. Because that, of course, explains sometimes to a large extent if people answer in high numbers or not. But it also explains if there is a lot of doubt about a specific issue or if there is a clear vision about a specific issue. And these categories are fairly high. In fact, the lowest is if the truth of all the facts and events of the war would be known, which also explains why there is a strong emphasis on the general pattern. But in other cases, like 41% don't know or 30% don't know, that's very high. And so that sort of colors also the data. So one has to be very careful here. Yeah?
Sorry, just read the report that you said.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Could the don't know also be because, I don't know whether this was distributed in English.
No. This was translated.
Yeah. Okay, so the don't know is not because it didn't understand what I'm reading.
Which is, by the way, a complex exercise, because the questionnaire is in English, then it had to be translated. There is one open question, and that the response to that open question need to be translated back to English in order to actually facilitate the processing of the data, which is a bit complex. And,
Is there no middle category?
Sorry?
Is there a middle category?
No.
Is that could count for some of the don't
know? Yes, correct, yeah. We've hesitated about that, should we have it or not? And on the basis of previous research, which was about a completely different topic, about the opinions of the Belgian population vis-a-vis the justice system in Belgium, we concluded that it would be better not to have a middle category, because usually when you have that, you know, out of five or out of seven possibilities, everyone's going to the center. Or at least only those with very explicit opinions go to either side. And it's a bit tricky, because then at the end you end up with a very a very, well, compromised solution almost. So we actually forced people to say either yes or either no, a little bit or a lot. But it's true. It could be that some of the I don't knows are not really I don't knows, but are, you know, undecided kinds of. So in any case, maybe that's something to reconsider if the questionnaire would be administered again in a second type of research. Because of course the data are getting a bit old now, in 2006 and 2007. In fact, the ideal would be to be able to repeat it. And we're actually looking for funds to enable us to do that, because it's quite a time-consuming activity. The basic work has been done, of course, with the questionnaire, but collecting the data and doing analyses and so on also requires time. And in other words, then you would really have like two pictures, and you wouldn't be enabled to compare the results over time. In the Bosnian survey, many of these things come back. Many of these things come back. For example, here, I could know the reasons why those who caused the suffering did this to me. It's over 50%. Here, it's even higher, the idea of what happened to my relatives and friends who are missing. Not coincidentally, of course, because in Bosnia, many people are still missing, tens of thousands. But in Serbia, that's far less the case. Memorial building is also here. We heard from the mothers of Srebrenica who were at the seminar where the data were presented, or the results, that's really very important for the idea of memorialization, collective memory, and also acknowledgement in that sense. But also the general pattern, 85% says, I want to know what actually happened in Bosnia. And so far, we haven't had good answers to that question. Here, the I don't know categories are sometimes high, but not consistently, and far less the case than in the Serbian case, which is interesting also. It seems like Bosnians are more outspoken, that they have a clearer idea of whether they are for or against certain issues, whether that means that they have been talking about that or discussing in society remains open, because I don't think there is a lot of discussion at the end of the day, except about what happens in The Hague and in the war crimes chamber. But in fact, in society in Bosnia, it doesn't seem to be a real issue for the moment. which brings us to reconciliation. Again, some bits and pieces of the two surveys. Here's the Serbian survey, in which we asked, do you think it's possible for members of the following ethnic groups to reconcile? And here the focus is on individual reconciliation. It's on the micro level, let's say. And well, here we asked different kind of questions about which groups they would think would be able to reconcile. And you see that the highest number of things, well, Serbs and Slovenians, that would work. Yeah. Well, Slovenians are not really the issue, it seems to me. But, well, for the sake of clarity and comprehension. Serbs and Bosnian Muslims, 54. So that's a slight majority, but not a very convincing one. Croats and Bosnian Muslims, also 54. What that means is hard to say. At least we have a first indication. It seems in all the others, excuse me, the Serbs and Croats here, but then again, that was not really the center of the conflict. The center was between Bosnia and Serbia, in fact. Here is the Serbs from Serbia and Kosovo Albanians. That's fairly low. The number of no is higher here than the number of yes. And that also is an indication about that Kosovo issue, which is still pending. Yeah.
Sorry, do you know how many of the respondents to the Serbian survey were displaced?
Of those people asking? Of those people responding, excuse me.
The Serbian survey. Because that would be...
I don't know by heart. Yes, I don't know by heart. It's in our report, right. But that one was not circulated because we're still fine-tuning a couple of issues on statistical analysis before we actually get it out. But I could find that for you in case you're interested. But I can't just tell you by heart. That's.
So I think the level of interpretation, yes. The feeling, yeah. Is different among those displaced,
yeah.
Than
right.
Among the general population.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And here, Kosovo Serbs and Kosovo Albanians is basically the lowest of all. Yeah. And that again, is a bit of a worrisome detail, of course, when it comes to the future of Kosovo, it seems to us. This is, of course, well before the independence, so things may have changed, and that's why it would be interesting actually to ask the same questions again this time. Then here we go more to the collective level, members of the following ethnic groups to trust each other again, which is, well, it's about members of groups, but on the other hand, we ask the question, well, if you may not be willing to engage in individual reconciliation, would you think that groups could trust each other? This is a new concept that came up during the survey as we were discussing it, the issue of trust, and in fact, because of that psychological dimension, the issue of trauma management came up, and in fact, the model with the four issues that you see in the beginning has now been extended to include six. On the basis of this empirical work, we think there are even more issues that are so fundamental that every government or elite or country will have to deal with them in some way or another. But having said this, in fact, some of the data are very similar in the sense that the hierarchy, again, is respected as it was in the previous slide, but the figures themselves are somewhat different. In fact, are somewhat higher. Serbs and Slovenians, well, they could...
let's see, is this correct? No, this one is not correct, I'm sorry.
76 here, well, almost 77 and 71 here. Let's see, if we are more sophisticated, we could show you the graphs in a more detailed way. Some of the figures on reconciliation are higher, and some of the other figures on trust are higher. But basically, the hierarchy is being kept. So the difficulties, in other words, between certain groups extend both to issues of reconciliation and to issues of trust building. This is a quick roundup of factors that have helped or have not helped according to the respondents. And this is a category of not helped, and this is a category of helped. And here you have some very interesting findings. It seems that the attitudes and strategy of politicians have not been very conducive to actually build trust in Serbia. The same with schools. And this is quite interesting. Because normally one always says, well, schools are there to instill new values, new ways of conflict, settlement, and so on and so forth. This, at least according to the respondents again, it's their vision, it's not necessarily the reality, but it's their vision at least, or their idea, this is not really helpful. The role of the media is about 50-50 here. It's a little bit more to the negative, but it's not really statistically significant enough to actually say it is negative, and it's so close to 50%, in fact. To the role of non-governmental organizations, on the other hand, has clearly helped to build trust. And this is an interesting indicator, again, because that could mean many things. I mean, we didn't ask any older details. Well, what do you mean by that? Does it mean dialogue? Does it mean material assistance or what have you? But at least there is a reservoir, again, of issues that could be dealt with. This is a very straightforward answer, the positive memories that people had from the period before the war. So things were fine before that, then all of a sudden this conflict comes, and then things deteriorate. And so looking back and thinking about the pre-war situation is actually helping us to build trust. Now this is interesting, because here you have a potential avenue or entry point for restorative measures, if at all they would be implemented or tried out. Because that is really the fundamental philosophy of restoration, something that did work well in the past, that was disrupted for all kinds of reasons, and that you could go back to the situation ex ante, which is of course very questionable in individual cases, because sometimes people have been suffering so much and their harm has been too high to actually really go back to the past. But nevertheless, there's an interesting finding, I think. Another one that I would like to highlight is here, the time that has passed since the war has ended. this seems to suggest that the longer you wait, the more trust can actually be generated, can actually come into being, because people again have to live together in some way, and coexistence, in other words, maybe they're not the best of friends, but at least they coexist, they live close by. My neighbor, my enemy could become my neighbor, my friend, who knows? It's not so straightforward, obviously, but there is something here. And as you can see, the data do not allow us to draw very strong and very strict conclusions, I think. But they open up new ways of thinking about potential dealings with the past. This is, of course, a very interesting one, particularly in relation to the ICTY. Criminal prosecutions, has it helped? Well, obviously, the visions are not uniform here, but strangely enough, more people say no, in other words, here, it's about 50%, then they say yes, that's very clear. Now, if you hear the rhetoric about international criminal justice, it's almost the opposite. So here is an interesting factor, again, that contradicts some of the general assumptions about international criminal justice. Then, last one on Serbia, and I won't go into all the details, that will lead us too far, but this is the open question. What does reconciliation mean to you, or mean for you? Because we wanted to have a sense, you know, reconciliation, this incredibly difficult concept. Everyone is using it, well, you know better than anyone else, how difficult it is to actually come to grips with the idea of reconciliation. So let it come from people in the field, in this case. And what you see is that this is not exclusive, and so people could tick several boxes, but the highest number actually came from those who say it's peaceful coexistence. It's living next to one another. Not necessarily in wonderful harmony, but at least we have to move on. You know, like in the Mille Collines in Rwanda, they have to move on because they're living next to one another. But in peace, meaning at least the absence of arms, the absence of armed struggle. At least that's how we would like to interpret this. Respect and tolerance is also highly quoted. These are the high categories. And then, strangely enough, forgiveness. How about that? Forgiveness. Now, again, a very difficult concept with a very strong religious connotation, obviously. Now, this coming from a Serbian survey could maybe bring us to the hypothesis that it has to do something with orthodoxy or with Christianity in general. Who knows? A big question mark, and I don't want to draw too strong conclusions here, but nevertheless something worth exploring. Now, in the Bosnian case, here we have a little bit of a pie. This is what we end up in the Bosnian case. Do you think it's possible for people to trust each other? Do you think it's possible for people to reconcile with one another? And it doesn't take much to see that basically it's split in three. Yes, no, and I don't know. And maybe that's, again, people who say, well, I haven't made up my mind, and then actually answer, I don't know, because they don't want to answer yes or no. But in other words, it's one-third, one-third, one-third. That's quite clear. If we get to the same table here, same questions have been asked. Here in Bosnia, there is more positive thinking about the schools than in Serbia. The negative thinking about politicians is also there, and in fact, it's even stronger than in Serbian kids. But in schools, it's more positive. Although it's not extremely high, it's also 50-50, but it's definitely higher than in Serbia. The media, I think, are equally problematic here, and non-governmental organizations also have a higher score than other fields. And positive memories, again, that's but a bit less than in the Serbian case, and the time that has passed also. So there are so many interesting things that come out of this this survey, and if we really want to have a closer look at it, we would need like a full day at least to go into all the details. So just a couple of salient things, and then I'll move to the last part on social media studies. Unfortunately, David has to leave, as I understand, but he is the expert, and in other words, he has nothing to learn about this part. What we found out is, in relation to reparation and reconciliation, there is a lot of trauma. I think that really sticks out, and it's not the only conclusion, but it is one. And in terms of reparation, the symbolic aspect seems to us really important. It's one that consistently comes back in the survey through various ways and through various questions. The idea that people did suffer and therefore want to be recognized as having suffered. And as long as that is not done, I think there's a lot of potential for further conflict. Not necessarily the same kind of war or violent conflict of the past, but a lot of underlying conflict, latent conflict. There is still a lot of distrust, it seems to us, and it's relative to talk about a lot or not a lot, because of course it all depends on your criteria. But nevertheless, you would think that 15 years down the line, things would have improved a little bit. The idea of experiences of the past is a very interesting point, I think, although we don't know exactly how to put our finger on the potential there. But this could maybe be a point of entry for discussing previous experiences and previous relationships. On the other hand, there also seems, not only from the slides that you saw, but also from others, a lot of lack of, real lack of information about all kinds of things, about what's really happening in Bosnia, what has happened. There hence also the need to know more about the conflict. And strangely enough, to our surprise, there was very little talk about socioeconomic issues, about poverty, about disadvantages in society, and what have you. Even in the list of the open question on reconciliation, there's very little that actually says reconciliation is economic development. Sometimes you find that in certain areas, and of course it may have to do with the state of Bosnia and Serbia also, which is not extremely rich, but on the other hand, is probably better off than a number of other countries, African, Latin American countries, where the issue of reconciliation usually goes more into the direction of social justice or distributive justice or more interest for that dimension. So, let me try to open up a new field in the sense of combining two things. Because, as I said in the beginning, I find it very striking that sociology of law, or in the broad term, social legal studies, have been so absent, in fact, from a theoretical point of view, in transitional justice. It is a very special kind of justice, sometimes not, but it's definitely worthwhile to investigate what could be done. And what I'm trying to do here is not offer answers. It's basically trying to open up new spaces for further research. So I'm trying to look here, what do I see personally, and it's a very colored and very narrow vision, of course, but what do I see as potential types of research or bodies of research that we can use in order to generate further ideas and further knowledge? Because there is a lot in sociology of law, of course, applied to a completely different set of issues in usually fairly stable societies. In the Western world, and I know it's very risky, of course, to do the transfer, because there we enter into another debate of legal transplants. But on the other hand, it is definitely worthwhile exploring. So to start with, let me stay as close as possible to the survey. I think there's a lot of room for public opinion research, in fact. And there is a lot of public opinion research coming out the last 10, 15, 20 years, maybe, out of criminology, in fact, but also out of sociology of law. One of the few people who has really argued that voices from below should be heard, transitional justice from below, you all know, is Kieran McAvoy. Who obviously is moving into that direction and is also using that concept from below, or counter-hegemonic sometimes, to use another concept, to bring out new ideas. But there are also old and very old bodies in the sociolegal field. For example, all the Cole research, you still remember, 1970s, knowledge and opinion about law. What do people actually know? How does that guide their actions? In which way are their opinions formed? I think is really useful if we go into some of that and try to understand in which way it could be helpful to understand what people in post-conflict societies are going through. So just a couple of names, I won't highlight all the details here. Then something which I think could be very interesting is the Habermasian approach, the dialogue situation. Of course, it's an ideal, typical situation whereby everyone would be able to contribute to a certain discussion in society, and you have all these five principles that the dialogue situation has to comply with in order to be an ideal dialogue situation. But going back to, for example, Bosnia or Serbia, and in that case, I don't think there's a really difference between the two countries. That seems to be lacking exactly. Discussion in society. Also because the power play is very strong, and there is clearly people and parties and actors with more power and those who are disadvantaged. So is it thinkable of applying some of the principles of Habermas into post-conflict society, particularly Bosnia and Serbia, but maybe even others? Because if that would be thinkable, then of course there are a couple of prerequisites that need to be met. Think of Rwanda, what kind of prerequisites would have to be met? Or Guatemala, for that matter. In fact, in order for people to participate in the discussion, they need information, they need a voice, they need representatives, possibly. They need the absence of power politics. And so you're actually opening up space that could be really interesting. With one of our doctoral researchers, I've tried to do some of that, the process approach in particular, in relation to reparations for victims. And we try to apply in the context of the trust fund for victims at the ICC level, what that could mean in theoretical terms. How could victims be included in the process about services for victims? In other words, for themselves. And is it possible to think about that? It's, again, ideal, typical, possibly, but there is some room, I think, for further debate. And then, of course, there's a lot of work that has already been done on the relationship between public policy and public opinion. Public opinion and public policy making, or public policy in the field of justice, because obviously one has to be very careful. It's not because 51% of one survey says, we think along those lines that automatically public policy needs to be adapted to that. And it's far more complex, and the intermediary function of public opinion as an extra source of information, I think, is useful. But that we know from ordinary research in this field. Then I'm told to try to wrap up, but I would want to deprive you from two or three other issues. The whole body of literature in relation to the mobilization of law. Blankenburg, our German-Dutch colleague, has done a lot of work. Why do people actually go to judges? Why do people actually submit cases to a court? And this is a bit outside of the criminal justice field, obviously, but not coincidentally, because in fact, in reparation, you don't have to go through criminal justice. You could go through civil justice in specific cases, or you could use alternative mechanisms to actually enter a judicial decision without having to wait for a criminal law. So I think it's relevant to think along those lines. There is this famous expression, naming, blaming, and claiming, in sociology of law. You name a particular problem as a judicial conflict, or as a legal conflict, then you try to indicate, well, who is to blame for that? And then the third step is the claiming phase. What is the claim that I actually propose against a certain person or entity? Now, it seems to me that this is really interesting when it comes to reparation, because that's exactly what reparation will be about. It will be about blaming that person who's thought to be responsible and issuing a claim against a person or against the state, for that matter. So how does that work in reality? Really interesting. There's a famous other work of Mark Galanter on one-shotters and repeat players. people who actually go to the justice system but are in very different positions. One shot as being those who basically are confronted with law and justice once in their life, and repeat players don't do anything else but going to justice and using the justice system. And in fact, those are more the organizations, and the bank, insurance companies, big firms and what have you. But in terms of court, and this applies both to criminal court and to civil court, you will have these main differences again. It's not because you're a victim that you necessarily have a lot of resources. Maybe on the contrary. So what's that mean in post-conflict situations seems quite interesting. And Rick Abel's work on cause lawyering, as he calls it, you know, specific legal expertise, which is built up in the legal profession, and you get, well, almost like an industry of legal professionals dealing with these kind of issues. Now, that's not too difficult to imagine how that works in international criminal justice. Two more things, if you allow me, and then I'll finish up here. The body of literature on informal justice, I think, is fascinating here, because if we are opening up our minds to think of post-conflict justice as not only international criminal justice or national criminal justice, and not only retributive justice, but could also have other fields, then the whole literature on ADR all of a sudden comes into the ambit. ADR, alternative dispute resolution, mediation, arbitration, everything in between, conciliation, reconciliation even. So there's a lot of literature that deals in the socio-legal field with non-state mechanisms. Out of the US, in fact, non-state mechanisms who operate often in the shadow of the law, literally speaking. And I would be fascinated to actually go into that more and to say, well, in certain countries, that's exactly what you have already. Rwanda being a good case in point. At least if you can argue that some of these mechanisms are non-state, and that's another tricky point possibly. But in other countries, things are being used. Even in South Africa, which is so well known for its Truth Commission, but there are non-state mechanisms ongoing. Peace committees, peace circles, that are actually trying to come to terms with some of the legacies of the past and of the present. Of course, this leads to a new conception of law as one of pluralistic legal orders rather than monistic or centralist legal orders. Sally Merritt has done a lot of work, and here we're entering anthropology of law as much as sociology of law. Sousa Santos, for those who are familiar with his work, the interlegality, in other words, the various layers of law that are applicable. Again, Rwanda, I think, is a wonderful example, because exactly that's what you have from the international to the local and everything in between. David Trubeck and others have argued that, in fact, we need to get away from that justice system and that obsession with the justice system, because, in fact, through his empirical research, he tries to demonstrate that only 10% of all legal conflicts actually end up in the justice system before a court. In other words, 90% is dealt with in a different way. Now, how could that be imaginable in a post-conflict situation, whereby, of course, you have very, very serious crimes, but nevertheless, we all know that only the tip of the iceberg is coming before a criminal court, and that all the rest is basically still there, but it's not dealt with. Is it possible that we have a conflict map, let's say, in terms of where our conflicts starting and what actually happens with them along the way? And finally, some ideas about lawmaking theories, because it's not only dealing with crimes of the past in a judicial or non-judicial way, but it's also about conceptualizing how to deal with crimes of the past. There are a lot of different theories about lawmaking. Some more rationalist, lawmaking is for the common good. Others about moral entrepreneurs. Howard Becker's famous expression, lawmaking is actually taken forward by a small number of highly motivated and highly morally responsible individuals or groups. Think of the child protection area, which is really child rights booming. And then there's a more conflictual point of view. You know, it's like an eternal conflict between various groups in society. And depending on who takes, who is strong at one particular point, you would get a certain outcome. This is interesting when it comes to international criminal justice. Why, in some cases, have tribunals been established, and in so many other cases, not? Cambodia had to wait 30 years. For the DRC, there is nothing for Congo for the moment, although it's probably the worst conflict of all. So why is that? And I think unless we go into the findings and the insights in that literature, it's going to be an eternal struggle to increase our own insights. Mark Drabble has done quite some interesting work tentatively towards the area of judicial lawmaking, judges as lawmakers, because the norms are so open that in fact they have to take the lead, and he's specifically referring to the ICTY case law, which has really been developing international law and international criminal law. And then not to forget, of course, where are the mass media in this whole setup to bring up the victimization and the conflict in the first place, and then to focus on specific issues. When Mladic is caught today, the next days will be dominated, I'm sure, by that particular story. And where is all the rest of that story in Serbia and in Bosnia? This is how we imagine Bosnia and Serbia. There is a tentative bridge, very carefully construed. This is not the Mostar bridge, for all clarity, because that's a solid one. But you can see how tentative it is. It's very fragile. Anything can happen at any time. And from what we've learned and what we've experienced and the kinds of people and actors we've talked to in our particular field of Serbia and Bosnia, we think that this grasps very well in one image what's going on. This is not to say that it's the same in all countries. Of course not. Every country having its own history also has its own state of affairs. But it's worthwhile thinking of how different countries, because of their different experiences, are actually evolving. So here's a little bit of that, and I hope I've not been too long in trying to expose my enthusiasm for this kind of research, and hopefully also conveying some of that too. So I really look forward to sharing some ideas and questions from your side. Thanks.
Thanks, Stefan.